Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Taiwan has forged what is being described as a groundbreaking trade deal with New Zealand, the island's first such accord with a developed economy. It was signed in a low-key ceremony in Victoria University in Wellington, and authorities on both sides have so far been unavailable for comment. Phil Goff is the foreign affairs trade spokesman for the New Zealand opposition Labour Party, and he explains his role in the arrangement to Richard Ehrwart.
It would not have been possible, of course, without a free trade agreement between New Zealand and China, which I signed as then Minister of Trade in April 2008. Having a comprehensive free trade agreement with mainland China, which is their first and still their only free trade agreement with a developed country, meant that we were subsequently able to forge a free trade agreement with Hong Kong and now finally with Taiwan. It's comprehensive. Immediately that we bring the deal into effect, the tariffs will be removed off nearly half of all of our exports to Taiwan. And after 4 years, that'll be up around 98-99%. So it's a comprehensive removal of tariffs. It involves the broadening of an air services agreement, which removes the cap of the number of flights between the two countries each week. That will be potentially good for our tourist industry. And it sets a framework for television and film co-productions, which will allow, you know, quite vibrant industries on both sides to work closely together. So, you know, for us, it means pretty quickly that there'll be, $40 million a year that we currently pay in tariffs that will be lifted. But it means much more than that. It means a broadening of the economic relationship between the two countries and a further free first mover advantage for New Zealand in terms of its exports into Taiwan.
It's interesting that you say that the deal has come about because of the free trade agreement that was already signed with China, because this deal does seem to have been dealt with fairly quietly, shall we say, not a great deal of razzmatazz surrounding the signing. And people might suggest that it would be quite a sensitive issue, but from what you're saying, you would say not.
Look, you can be sure that the commencement of the negotiation and the conclusion of the negotiation and the signing of this deal was done with the full knowledge and indeed concurrence of the People's Republic of China. We work on a no surprises deal with the People's Republic of China. It's currently our biggest export market, eclipsing Australia in the first 3 months of this year. And no government would jeopardise the trading relationship with a major country like the People's Republic of China by entering into a free trade agreement with Taiwan, unless there was an acknowledgement on China's side that they had no objections to this deal. We don't have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. We have what's called a cultural and industrial office in Taiwan, and they reciprocate with a trade and cultural office here. So the deal wasn't signed between government ministers. It was signed by officials, and it was signed on a neutral ground, which was the Victoria University of Wellington.
So at this stage, then, a government-to-government agreement would have been a bridge too far, perhaps, for China, but they're prepared to go along with the deal as it's been put together. And does that suggest that relations are changing, both between China and Taiwan, but internationally on this issue?
Well, the relation, I was in Taiwan earlier this year, and the relationship between the Kuomintang government in Taiwan and the mainland government in the People's Republic of China is actually quite a good one. Ironically, since the founder of the KMT was Chiang Kai-shek, former president of China before the communist takeover in 1949. But that relationship has certainly eased. That can't be guaranteed to continue because the major opposition party in Taiwan, the DPP, has a policy that at least potentially contemplates a declaration of independence from China. China sees Taiwan, of course, as a province of China, which historically is correct. They've worked out a reasonable way of getting along at the moment, but a political change in Taiwan could change all that. and it could again become a fairly tense hotspot in the politics of the Asia-Pacific area.
So bearing in mind you've signed these two groundbreaking deals, effectively, one with China and now another with Taiwan, can I perhaps invite you to speculate as to why Australia is still struggling to sign a free trade agreement with China, and then the pressure apparently is on now to get that deal done after 8 years of seemingly going nowhere?
Well, I probably can't speak for Australia on that, other than to say that I think Kevin Rudd is absolutely right in wanting to lift the momentum to try to get a deal with China. As the minister that negotiated the deal with China, I think it had a lot to do with building the wider relationship. In China, things aren't simply business. It's about Guangxi, which is Chinese for relationships, and you develop a relationship before you have a business connection. And that's a traditional and cultural part of the way in which China goes about things. So we worked very closely with China. Mike Moore was World Trade Organization Director General at the time of their accession into the WTO. We were the first country to sign an agreement for their accession to the WTO. We were the first country that recognized them as a market economy. We were then the first country to, in the developed world, to commence negotiations and then conclude them. And I think it was on the basis of a good relationship, and also it's hard, I guess, for China to feel threatened. You know, 1.3 billion people on one side of the negotiating table and 4.3 million on our side. But nevertheless, it was a tough negotiation. We pushed very hard and made a precondition for that, the total phasing out of tariffs on our dairy products. And we achieved a comprehensive agreement with China, which even included deals on trade and labour and trade and the environment, building into our free trade agreement international standards for labour and international standards for the protection of the environment. So I think it was a good success for New Zealand. It was based on good faith. It was based on our mutual interests and the fact that our economies are complementary. We produce things that China needs. We'd already removed most of the tariff barriers to Chinese goods coming into our country. And that certainly then opened the way for the subsequent deal on free trade with firstly Hong Kong and now with Taiwan.
Australia's foreign investment rules have been criticised by China, and a predominant Australian has called for improvements in the Foreign Investment Review Board. This past week, Chinese President Xi Jinping called for a speedy conclusion to bilateral free trade talks. But a major conference on China at the Australian National University has heard that Australians are seen to distrust or simply ignore the country. Karen Snowden has more.
The Conference of Leading Government and Academic Speakers heard how Chinese companies are hesitant about investing in Australia. Wang Bijun from the Chinese Government's Academy of Social Sciences says Chinese investment is declining in resource companies. She says that's in part due to the changing nature of the Chinese economy. But she says the government is concerned about the use of national security provisions in foreign investment rules, which are seen to disadvantage Chinese companies.
There is such concern. Is that putting off prospective foreign investment from China into Australia, that perception that it's not so, maybe not so welcome here?
I think that's part of the story, but that's not the whole story. Chinese investment in Australia have not that strong compared to about 2 or 3 years ago. The second thing is about the bad performance of Chinese investment in Australia because of the infrastructure, because of maybe the national security concern. So Chinese investors become more cautious. So they will tend to other countries such as the Canada.
Australia's immediate past Trade Minister Craig Emerson says there's no discrimination against Chinese investment in Australia.
There is screening of investment proposals, but at the same time, it's a reflection of the fact that the government in principle welcomes foreign investment, including from China. The record is that of 350 applications by Chinese investors for investment in Australia since late 2007, 350 have been approved, 6 with conditions.
Technically correct, but others have been discouraged. So says Professor Alan Fells from the Australian and New Zealand School of Government. He says the Foreign Investment Review Board should be made more independent and its processes more transparent.
Well, it's generally allowed quite a lot of Chinese investment, but times are changing and we need to have a more open, transparent, independent, accountable process than we've had in the past. At the moment, there's a very vague criterion, national interest. There are no real rights of appeal. And I think this does have some deterring effect, particularly on Chinese investment.
Do you think that the Huawei decision was the wrong one and the concerns about national security are misplaced in that case?
I think national security is a legitimate ground. No one knows, of course, because it's all secret, the reasons. But one of the troubles is that there are competitors out there who are pushing really hard on FIRB and the government to reject applications like that by Huawei.
Commercial competitors, do you mean?
Commercial competitors. Just as in the case of Chinelco Rio, which was never formally rejected, but the government delayed it for a tremendously long time, that was the result, again, of huge pressures and a bit of an orchestrated campaign initiated by some competitors who weren't too happy with that deal.
Alan Fells used to be the head of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. Competition will only hot up for Chinese investment as the world's biggest pot of money looks increasingly outside China for a home. Dan Rosen is an associate professor at Columbia University and the Chinese partner for the research and consulting Rhodium Group.
Well, there's a variety of estimates. My favorite guess is that by 2020, we'll see about $2.5 trillion stock of Chinese outward investment coming from $400 billion or so where we are today. The big question I'm not sure about is whether that will all be strong Chinese companies with a strong domestic base going out to extend their operations globally, or whether it'll be more runaway plants, more of the like of capital flight, as China mismanages its domestic macro reform and firms start trying to get assets abroad as a hedge against domestic conditions deteriorating. Either way, there are going to be these tremendous outflows.
The flow of investment funds might be driven by complex issues, as Dan Rosen suggests. But Australia's new trade minister wants to ensure the connection with Australia's largest trading partner keeps improving. Richard Miles hopes Australian business is aware of and is able to take up the opportunities in China. He says the relationship is at a turning point as the resources boom recedes and China shifts to a consumer and services economy.
I think it's fair to say that compared with the mining boom, Australians are less aware of the potential lying in the continued economic growth of China's inland cities, of the rising Chinese middle class and the opportunities it offers for countries all around the region, opportunities that we in Australia can take up.
Richard Miles is also bringing a new insight to the trade portfolio.
I'm a real believer in the power of sport. And the power of its ability to allow our connection. And golf is a great sport in that context. It is a fantastic tool for diplomacy. It is obviously a fantastic tool for business and for doing trade.
The New Zealand government is suspending millions of dollars in tourism aid to Tonga over concerns about safety of its domestic airline service. Tonga has been gifted a MA-60 for its Real Tonga airline, for use on its domestic flights by China. But as Brandon Arrow reports, the plane has one of the world's worst safety records.
The Tongan government was full of praise over the weekend, gratefully accepting an MA-60 plane as a sign of the strengthening ties between the Pacific nation and China. However, with a second plane expected to arrive in Tonga by the end of the year, questions are being raised about the safety of the aircraft. Since 2009, MA-60 planes have been involved in 11 incidents, including three of them in the last 2 months. Last month, Myanmar grounded its MA-60 planes for safety checks after two crash landings. Most of the crashes were caused by technical or system failures. These incidents have prompted New Zealand to suspend tourism funding to Tonga and may lead to a travel warning being placed on the government's website. New Zealand's Foreign Affairs Minister Murray McCulley told NZTV the highest safety standards would need to be met before New Zealand's tourism funding would flow to Tonga once more.
There are real concerns about the plane that has been imported in the last few days and until all of the safety certification is undertaken to a high standard, we've got things on hold.
The Tongan government is promising the new plane will not be allowed to fly until it meets international aviation standards. However, Malino Marker, the chair of the New Zealand Tonga Advisory Council, says getting that approval could take some time.
Given that the US and New Zealand and Britain actually not certified this type of plane because of the history, you know, I'm struggling to see how Tonga going to obtain certification for this type of plane. And I think that there needs to be someone from Tonga to explain that in plain language on how.
It was first announced that Tonga would be receiving a new plane at the start of the year when the government revealed it was bringing in a Chinese-run service. This service saw the New Zealand-run company Air Chatham's pull out of Tonga's domestic airline market, with company officials saying they couldn't compete against a subsidised service, especially in such a small market. Mr Marker again.
I think this is the facts of the matter. It actually was started from there. And I think that you know, New Zealand should act like a big brother and try to understand Tonga. Even that what the Tongan leadership is actually deal with Chatham Air, at the end, Tonga is a sovereign country. But at some stage, you know, that they need to, you know, to pull their heads together.
But those future talks couldn't happen soon enough, with Tongan residents and businesses already under pressure.
The impact has already happened because I know some member of our Tongan community wanted to go to visit relatives, and when they heard about the plane saga, and actually they decided to cancel. The impact is already happened, but the long-term impact on Tonga and also tourism is going to be quite devastating. It's a high stake, and while everybody is in terms of government level trying to hold their position, you know, the business and also the people will be the loser.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Millions of cows from India are being illegally herded across the border to slaughterhouses in Muslim-dominated Bangladesh every year. The smuggling network is vast and many people profit from the trade. But human rights groups say this is a result of people being beaten, tortured, and sometimes killed by border guard security forces. India correspondent Stephanie March reports.
Cows are revered among India's Hindus. Killing one can even attract a jail sentence.
Cows are very important animals. Not only do cows give us milk, or we can use them in the fields, but the cow is like God to us.
It's illegal to export them for slaughter, but that's not enough to stop millions of them being killed for their meat each year. Neighbouring Muslim-majority Bangladesh has a big appetite for beef, which fuels a massive illegal cow smuggling trade.
In India, they have a big space for the cows because it's a big country. Our country is small. It's difficult for us to keep the cows.
Thousands of cows come through this cattle market in India's West Bengal state every day. Many of them are bound for Bangladesh. It's thought 2 million cows are smuggled across the border each year, creating an illegal industry worth almost $1 billion.
The illegal trade involves a vast network of people, from corrupt politicians and police to poor farmers who can make 20 times more in a day smuggling cows than they would working in the fields.
When we hand over the cow, we know very well the cow will be killed. Everyone knows about these things. We know that the cow is God, but we have to hand it over to those people. What we do it for money.
It's a risky business and a potentially fatal one, not just for the cows.
The border security force is very aggressive. Sometimes it uses firearms and sometimes boys are killed. Lots of incidents like that have happened in my area.
According to human rights groups, over the past decade, India's border security force has shot and killed more than 1,000 people along the Indo-Bangla border. Many have been poor farmers mistaken for cow smugglers. Legalising the trade could be a way to reduce deaths on the border.
It has to really be a joint effort to ensure that trading in illegal items are not done, which would ensure at least lives are saved.
An idea that's strongly opposed by Hindu nationalist groups.
Once the government legalises cow smuggling, then it will happen in a huge way, so we never accept it.
Agreement on what's worth more to the people of India, the life of a cow or the life of a person, seems a long way off.
That was Stephanie March reporting from India. Internet giants Google, Yahoo, Facebook, and eBay have criticized Singapore's move to tighten regulations of news websites. In a letter to Singapore's Communications and Information Minister, the web companies said the proposed licensing regime has negatively impacted Singapore's global image as an open and business-friendly country. Under the new rules, selected news websites which report regularly on Singapore would be licensed and a $50,000 performance bond placed. Any story deemed objectionable by authorities would need to be taken down within 24 hours. Sen Lam asked Dr. John Yuri, the executive director of the Asia Internet Coalition, to give more background on this.
The first point to make is that it took everybody by surprise, because although we had been in some discussions with the government on internet regulations and Singapore's attitude to internet regulation, which up to now has been fair and free and quite liberal, this came without any consultation with the industry. Everybody was caught by surprise, and we've made the point that all the powers that they have are already in existence. They're all in the Broadcasting Act, so we couldn't understand why now they want to issue special additional licenses to 10 companies, one of which is one of our members, which is Yahoo.
And how exactly will it affect companies like Yahoo?
Well, that remains a bit uncertain, because the implementation process, we've been told, would be light-handed. But how that works out in practice, we don't obviously know at this stage. Ideally, it won't have any immediate impact, which raises the question of then why is it necessary in the first place?
Well, the Singapore government says the new licensing framework is not intended to curb internet freedom, but to make the rules on news websites more consistent, in line with those governing the more traditional media, like newspapers, for instance. So why shouldn't the net come under the same rules?
Well, in practice, it already does, because the powers that the government have, for example, for issuing takedown notices, already exist. So the question is, why extend regulations in this way? Now, we're not aware of another agenda, but it's the signalling that we're concerned with, because while the practice in Singapore has been good up to now, there are other countries in the region where it is not so good. And they will be looking to countries like Singapore to see what direction they're heading in. And that's one of our concerns, that they seem to be heading in the wrong direction.
The Asia Internet Coalition, I understand, has written to the Singapore government. What do you hope that would achieve?
Well, it's already achieved some consultation with us, not about the decision itself, but some assurance that the implementation process will involve consultation, although we're not clear to what extent that will extend to, for example, additional companies that might be included in the future. They've also talked about amending the Broadcasting Act to take into account the fact that many of the internet operators are not Singaporean, so they would look at the jurisdiction issues. And they have said that they will consult with the industry when they're going to introduce changes to the legislation. So we'll have to wait and see how that works out.
And do you think this very vocal criticism of the PAP government's move by companies like Facebook, Google, and indeed your members, the members of the AIC, do you think that this might be a sign that Singapore's place as a regional information hub is far from assured?
Well, in the longer run, everything is far from assured, because we live in a very fluid and rapidly developing local environment and regional environment. Let's put this into context. There were moves towards the end of last year at the ITU by some countries who wished to extend state control over internet governance. In that context, we were very keen to talk to the Singapore government that this would not imply some tightening up or change of direction within Singapore. We were given assurances that that would be the case, but of course now, without consultation, these changes have been introduced. That does raise some question marks for us, and undoubtedly international internet companies will be asking questions about where they put their investments, where they put their servers in the future.
Indeed, the internet and related companies or related industries have become an important sector for Singapore, valued at about $100 billion, I understand. Do you think that this might provide your voice a little bit more clout?
Well, our members obviously want to maintain a very good working relationship with the government here in Singapore because Singapore has got an excellent infrastructure and it's got some very progressive policies. It does have a free and open internet access currently, but obviously there are going to be options opening up, alternatives in the future, and our members, and Google, by the way, is a member, and so is Facebook, a member of the coalition, they're inevitably going to be looking at what the alternatives are over, you know, not just in the next 6 months, but over, say, the next 5 years. So the direction in which rules and regulations take place will have a big impact. I should just add that we've had just issued a report done for us by the EIU, Economist Intelligence Unit. They did a report for us very recently for India, and they did a survey around Asia asking the question, why is it that it's not Asian internet companies that are going international? Why is it always, you know, companies, for example, from North America that dominate the global market? And one of the key points they raised was restrictive regulations and rules governing internet in many of the Asian countries. So Asia has a choice of which direction to go in, and people inevitably look to places like Singapore for their lead. That's doubly important to us, that they send the right signals, not the wrong signals.
And with that, we conclude this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. I want to remind you again, you can catch another edition of the program Sunday at 1330 UTC on 11835 kilohertz with Andy Sennett. So that's Sunday, 1330 UTC on 11,835 kilohertz, Focus Asia Pacific with Andy Sennett. If you wish to contact us and let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team that helped put the program together, I'm Keith Perron wishing you well, hoping to see you again very soon. Until next time, friends, so long and take care.